From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross.
Hey, are you Joyce?
Hey, Harvey.
Hey.
So we finally meet in person.
Hey. Look, before we get started with any of this, you might as well know right off the bat I had a vasectomy.
It's Friday the 13th and the day before Valentine's Day, so we're going to celebrate a story that's about crummy luck and love, American Splendor. That's Harvey Pekar's underground autobiographical comic book series, started when he was a file clerk in a VA hospital. The movie American Splendor came out last year to great critical acclaim. We'll talk to Pekar and his wife, Joyce Brabner. Also, we'll hear from Paul Giamatti, who plays Pekar in the film. Also, film critic David Edelstein looks at 50 First Dates, the new romantic comedy starring Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has authorized the release of more of his military and medical records from the Vietnam War era. The documents come in response to allegations that the president did not fulfill his obligations as a member of the Texas Air National Guard. NPR's Don Gagne is among reporters going through the documents.
There are hundreds of pages that they have released, some of them medical records, some of them the more general military service record from the president's time in the National Guard. Significant, though, is that none of these addresses that very basic question that has been out there. Did the president show up for all of the required duty in 1972 after he had transferred from Texas to Alabama to work on a political campaign of a family friend there? But the White House clearly feels that by putting this all out there, it demonstrates that they're not hiding anything.
NPR's Don Gagne at the White House. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said today that inmates at the U.S. military prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, will now be given a chance to appeal their detentions.
For those detainees who pose a continued threat and who do need to be detained, the U.S. government is instituting a process for an annual review.
If the review determines that the prisoner is no longer a threat, Rumsfeld says he'll be freed. Human rights groups have criticized the United States for holding some 650 prisoners at Guantanamo without access to lawyers or to family members. Rumsfeld said the inmates are enemy combatants or terrorists, so different rules apply. Four men accused of selling steroids to pro athletes pleaded not guilty to federal charges today. After the court hearing, the coaches and executives from the San Francisco area company Balco were allowed to go home for now. Molly Peterson reports from member station KQED.
In the 42 counts to the indictment, trainers Greg Anderson and Remy Korchemny were charged with distributing steroids and human growth hormone. Anderson is a longtime friend of baseball player Barry Bonds, and Korchemny has made a career of coaching track and field Olympians. After the hearing, lawyer Doug Schwartz defended Korchemny.
The smorgasbord of charges is so easy to bring, but will prove to be quite impossible to sustain because the truth will prevail.
Balco owner Victor Conti and company vice president James Valenti deny their share of the charges, including laundering money to cover up the drug conspiracy. No athletes who testified to the grand jury have been charged. The four men arraigned will go back to court to set bail in 2 weeks. For NPR News, I'm Molly Peterson in San Francisco.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 66 points to close at 10,627 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index was down 20 points, or nearly 1%. It closed at 2053. This is NPR News. A Seattle man who pleaded guilty to supporting the Taliban has been sentenced to 2 years in prison. Derek Wong reports from member station KUOW in Seattle.
38-year-old James Ujamaa was arrested in July 2002 and indicted for conspiring to set up a terrorist training camp in Oregon. That charge was dropped last April when Ujamaa pleaded guilty to supplying the Taliban with cash and computers in 2000. Investigators also say Ujamaa ran a website for a suspected al-Qaeda recruiter based in London, Abu Hamza al-Masri. As part of the plea agreement, Ujamaa has been telling prosecutors what he knows of al-Masri. Federal officials declined to give details of what Ujamaa has told them, but say his cooperation has been substantial. Ujamaa will have to continue cooperating with terrorist investigations for the next 10 years. As part of his sentence, Ujamaa will receive credit for time served and will be released in July. For NPR News, I'm Derek Wong in Seattle.
A state judge in San Francisco refused today to issue a temporary restraining order to block the city from issuing marriage licenses and performing wedding ceremonies for same-sex couples. The judge told lawyers for the Alliance Defense Fund, which opposes gay marriage, that they hadn't presented enough evidence to show that immediate damage would be done if the marriages were stopped. And the judge stressed that he didn't rule on the merits of the case. At the direction of City Mayor Gavin Newsom, city officials have performed marriage ceremonies for hundreds of same-sex couples in the past 2 days. The actions challenge a California law that defines marriage as the union of one man and one woman. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, dedicated to advancing entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The movie American Splendor, based on the defiantly personal comic book series written by Harvey Pekar, has just come out on DVD. When it was released last year, it received rave reviews from critics for its original subject matter and structure, and was honored at the Sundance and Cannes film festivals. At Cannes, it received the coveted Grand Jury Prize. The movie just picked up an Oscar nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. It's adapted from the American Splendor comics, a series of autobiographical stories Pekar has published since 1976. They're about his daily life, working as a file clerk in Cleveland's VA hospital, collecting jazz records, running into annoying friends and strangers on the street, dealing with the ups and downs of married life, and being constantly disgruntled about how little money he makes. His book-length comic Our Cancer Year, co-written with his wife Joyce Brabner, was about having lymphoma. Pekar doesn't draw, so he relies on artists to illustrate American Splendor, including his old friend R. Crumb. The movie stars Paul Giamatti as Pekar and Hope Davis as Joyce Brabner. They first connected through letters and phone calls when Brabner was a partner at a comic book store in Delaware. Here's a scene of one of those early phone calls.
So you married or what?
I'm divorced, thank God.
Look, I think you and I got a lot in common, you know? How am I going to get you to come visit me in Cleveland?
Cleveland?
Yeah.
You think that's a good idea?
Yeah, it's a great idea. You know, you should meet me because I'm a great guy. You know, despite the way my comics read, I got a lot of redeeming characteristics.
I don't know. Where would I stay?
I don't know. With me. You know, don't worry. I'm not going to put no moves on you.
I'm not worried about that. Hold on. I just spilled my chamomile tea all over my...
Yeah.
Although American Splendor stars Hope Davis and Paul Giamatti, the real Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner are interviewed within the film, commenting about their lives. We invited Pekar and Brabner to talk with us.
Harvey Pekar, Joyce Brabner, welcome to Fresh Air.
How
do you think the movie American Splendor compares with your real lives? Harvey, let's start with you on that.
My real life? I'm even more harried and frantic than you see there.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Joyce, what do you think?
Well, it's, you know, we're watching people who look better than we do and, you know, sitting on furniture that's better than the stuff that we have. And for some reason, everything that's happening to them has an arc and it seems to all be taken care of in, 80, 90 minutes, you know. So things go awfully fast.
Whereas real life leads in many directions
yeah.
and in slow motion.
Yeah.
Could we listen to a scene together from early in the film American Splendor? And in this scene, let me back up and say, Joyce, you were a partner in a comic book store in Delaware and a fan of
right.
American Splendor. And then you and Harvey started communicating by mail and then phone. Then you decided to meet in Cleveland, where Harvey lived and still lives. And then Harvey, and then in the movie, Harvey takes you, Joyce, to a restaurant. And here's the scene as you're looking over the menus. And this is right after you first met. And Hope Davis is playing Joyce Brabner. Paul Giamatti is playing Harvey Pekar.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Something's wrong. You keep looking around everywhere.
I guess I never imagined you'd eat in a place like this.
What, me? No, I've never been here. I thought you'd like it. But obviously you don't, do you?
It's fine. What difference does it make?
I don't know. None, I guess. Man, I got a lot of meat on this menu.
You're a vegetarian?
Kinda, you know. I mean, ever since I got a pet cat, you know, I've had a lot of trouble eating animals.
Huh. I support and identify with groups like PETA, but unfortunately, I'm a self-diagnosed anemic.
Uh-huh.
Also, I have all these food allergies to vegetables, which give me serious intestinal distress. I guess I have a lot of borderline health disorders that limit me politically when it comes to eating.
Wow, you're a sick woman.
Not yet, but I expect to be. Everyone in my family has some sort of degenerative illness.
Would you compare that scene from the film
with what really happened
in the restaurant when you went out to dinner?
Okay. Well, Harvey didn't take me to a really fashionable, you know, yuppie chain. He took me to McDonald's. And I just was a real good sport and sat there and ate the French fries. he was, but I guess Bob and Sherry decided that I deserved better. And
they're the directors and writers.
The directors, right. And then they based some of what they saw on observations of us as we are now. And actually at the time, I was the vegetarian and Harvey would eat different kinds of meat. And that was my cat that turned Harvey into an ardent vegetarian after we moved in. So, but it's, you know, who cares? I mean, these are things that I don't even think my mother knows.
So Joyce, Hope Davis said that when she was acting early on in American Splendor, that she that you were giving her suggestions. And it was making her very self-conscious to have you on the set so that she asked you if you could leave. And I think it made her very uncomfortable asking you to do that, but she was just getting so self-conscious. What's your memory of that?
It's pretty different because the only contact I had with Hope was, you know, the time that we spent together before she went to work acting. We spent some time and, you know, she had questions and I tried to give her some answers and some explanations, you know, backstory, things like that, what was, you know, behind some of the stuff that was in the script. But I went down and I watched it and I watched it from a distance and I got a message from Ted Hope, the producer, sort of took me aside and said, Hope is freaking out. She feels like, you know, your eyes are burning into the back of her neck. And she just feels very, very uncomfortable doing this with you. And so I was asked not to come down and wash, although they did arrange for me to, from time to time, look at it through the remote or, I don't know, hide me out in the bushes or something like that. So it made me a little uncomfortable during lunch breaks because I would never know. You know, I tried to sit as far away from her as possible. And, you know, she'd say, come on over here, come on over here. And I think, I don't want to contaminate her with my Joyce-ness or whatever it is. But I never gave her any suggestions on the set. I never said anything. You can't do that because you have to be quiet and let them film.
When you both decided to meet in Cleveland, what were you expecting from each other? Harvey, what did you expect Joyce was going to be like? And did you think that this was going to be your wife?
Oh, I was sort of hoping it. Yeah. I expected she'd be like she'd been on the phone, you know, like pretty straightforward, maybe a little acerbic, and with a good sense of humor and, you know, basically a pretty honest person, and, you know, a person who's pretty loyal, and I guess that's what I got.
Joyce, what you were expecting based on not only your phone calls with Harvey, but, you know, reading his autobiographical comic.
It wasn't the reading. It was strictly the visuals. I thought much about this guy, but I really had to check him out in person to see whether or not he smelled bad, he had any twitches, Tourette-like syndrome, you know, symptoms, things like that, because I had no real clue as to what he looked like. And, you know, like I said in, well, I said in real life before I said it in the movie, that with the range of artists from Jerry Shamray to R. Crumb, you know, Harvey was presented to me as anything from, you know, the missing link to just this sort of, you know, this sort of noble, you know, with a high forehead, you know, young Brando type.
So where do you think he falls in that range? What did you think of him when you met him?
Well, he was more muscular than I thought he would be.
Harvey, in the movie, the first thing you say to Joyce when she gets off the bus in Cleveland is, you know, right off the bat, I want you to know I've had a vasectomy. Right. Is that the first thing you really said to her?
He said that to me when we were talking over the phone. He just, when I said I was coming out, he just blurted it out. But they don't show too much of the telephone conversation,
right.
So they just moved that up a bit. But it really had that kind of impact, you know, and just came out apropos of nothing.
Did that seem presumptuous to you?
To me?
Yeah.
It seemed Harvey.
Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with American Splendor creator Harvey Pekar and his wife, Joyce Brabner.
Joyce, when you got married to Harvey, you knew that you would be a character in his stories because the stories are autobiographical. And mm-hmm. So it changed your life not only because you now had, you know, a partner in life. You were also in a position where parts of your life together were going to be described in this comic book. What was it like for you to suddenly be a part of the comic book that you had read and to know that things that you said, things that you did might end up in the story?
Well, it was a little annoying because I could no longer enjoy the comics once a year. I always knew what was going in, and so I was deprived of that, you know, the experience of just opening a fresh new copy and finding out what had happened to this character this year. But it was sort of incumbent upon me to make sure that our marriage had a happy ending. I first became really aware of what was going on when, after about a year or so, people, you know, send fan mail to Harvey all the time, and we got letters that said things like, well, we weren't real sure about you, you know, in issue 9, but now that we've seen what's going on in issue 10, you know, it seems like you're here to stay and you're good for our man. And so, you know, the marriage was approved of by all these people who don't know who we are but just read about us in comics.
That's kind of weird, isn't it? I mean, to have readers weighing in on whether you're the right choice.
it's either people like that or relatives, and Harvey didn't come with a whole lot of in-laws and relatives.
That's funny. So you have to please the readers.
Yeah. And it matters just about as much. You know, we see them and hear from them about as often as you'd hear from, you know, long-distant aunts and cousins. And
you know, there's parts in American Splendor, the comic, and American Splendor, the new movie, where you seem to drive each other a little crazy. What's it like to expose that part of the relationship to the public? That's the kind of stuff people like to not have people see.
Well, actually, in my case, It's very liberating because now that everybody sees what I have to put up with, I mean, people are almost offended if Harvey doesn't have a meltdown or something or do something gauche or...
It's like part of the show.
Whatever. I think it's when you try and hide these things, you get into trouble. But now, it's like he gets paid to be this way. He gets paid to be squirrely.
Harvey, what's your take on this?
Well, I don't deliberately act, you know, neurotic, although I guess I am. But I don't try, you know, I don't do it because anybody's paying me to do it. And I'm glad that Joyce allows me, you know, so easily to write about our disagreements and stuff like that, because I don't want to idealize our marriage. At the same time, we've been together for 20 years now, and we're still working things out, and we're still, you know, growing. And I think it's a good marriage.
One of the best known works that you did was a collaboration between you and Joyce called Our Cancer Year, about the year that you were diagnosed with lymphoma and you had chemo, and you were very, very sick. But then you went into remission and seemed to be clear. And was it after retirement that it came back?
Yeah, that's where
it came. It came back right after the movie wrapped.
So did you have to do chemo all over again?
Yeah.
It wasn't as bad physically as last time. Actually, Harvey had been pronounced cured, and so this might actually be coincidental rather than related. But it was still really, really rough because he was still, you know, kind of depressed and out of sorts, trying to find his way after retiring. I mean, he'd retired, begun working on this movie, and then, boom, he's got a tumor again.
In what way was it not as bad as the first time around?
Medically, because when Harvey had his treatment 10 years ago, it was horrific. They were telling him he was taking the second harshest form of chemotherapy, the second harshest protocol, and it was very rough on him, but this time physically it was better. There is a lot of deja vu, though. I mean, George Bush was president then. George Bush was president when he had lymphoma this last time. We were in a Persian Gulf War. The first time he had cancer, another Persian Gulf War. I was involved with 15-year-olds from different countries who were war survivors, and now I'm guardian to a 15-year-old girl. So it kind of felt like we were stuck in the same tape loop.
Harvey, I'd like to ask you a few things about your background, starting with your parents. This comes from one of your comics you wrote about your family's attitudes toward getting into fights when you were a kid. You wrote, "My family considered physical violence and even sports as unthinkably barbaric activities fit only for Gentiles." Tell me a little bit about your parents.
Well, my parents were both from northeastern Poland, from shtetls. My mother's from a place called Brestowice, and my father's from a place called Nowy Dwór. And my mother came over to the United States first in the 1920s. And I don't know, I think maybe partly because she was, like, really short, you know. She couldn't find a husband, and she got sent back to Europe again in 1935, and I guess at that time, she was supposed to be, or maybe my relatives who were still there were supposed to be, you know, looking out for her and trying to find her somebody. And she did come up with my father. My father's, as long as I've known him, my father's been real religious, and my mother was a communist. We were for Henry Wallace in 1948, but they seem to have resolved their differences that way. I know that
they were both short.
Yeah, well, my mother wouldn't go to shul on the high holidays and stuff like that. But they got along. They respected their differences. I don't know of too many cases that are like that, because they both believed pretty strongly in what they in my mother's case in her politics, and my father's case in his religion.
I could see how both a communist parent and a religious parent would think that reading comic books was frivolous and something to be discouraged. What did your parents think of your interest in comic books and music or any other parts of pop culture?
Well, they thought it was just a waste of time. I didn't read comic books from the age of 11 until I moved out of the house, so that was one thing they didn't have to worry about. But I mean, and my father tried to be tolerant of jazz, although I don't think he liked it very much. He collected Chazonische records, you know.
What kind of records? Like
Chazonische, cantors.
Oh.
The records of cantors, like Yusula Rosenblatt or Moishe Kosovitsky, there used to be a guy that used to sing for the Met that was also a cantor by the name of Richard Tucker. I don't know if you know about him.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, he used to, my father was into collecting these records too. I wasn't the first record collector in the family.
Well, I regret we're out of time. I've really enjoyed talking to you both.
Thanks.
Love the movie, love the comic, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner, whose lives were dramatized in the movie American Splendor. The film has just come out on DVD and is up for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com, and from Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more American Splendor. We'll hear from Paul Giamatti, who plays Harvey Pekar in the film. And what does the real Harvey Pekar think about on Valentine's Day? He'll tell us. Also, film critic David Edelstein looks at the new romantic comedy 50 First Dates. That's all coming up on our Day Before Valentine's Day edition of Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Paul Giamatti, who stars as Harvey Pekar in American Splendor, is no stranger to strange roles, and in finding sympathetic moments in even the most seemingly abrasive parts. He played the radio executive in the movie version of Howard Stern's Private Parts, the character Stern nicknamed Pig Vomit. He's also been one of the memorable supporting players in Saving Private Ryan, Storytelling, The Truman Show, Mighty Aphrodite, and Tim Burton's remake of Planet of the Apes. He's the son of the late A. Bartlett Giamatti, who was a president of Yale University and served as baseball commissioner. In American Splendor, Paul Giamatti finally made the shift from supporting player to star. His character of Harvey Pekar was just as quirky, but this time he was at the film's center with equally odd people around him. Here's a scene where Giamatti, as Pekar, leaves a movie theater with his wife Joyce, played by Hope Davis, and their borderline autistic friend Toby, played by Judah Friedlander. The film they've just seen is Revenge of the Nerds.
It's just not the point.
I think you missed the whole point of the movie.
I like the pink.
Where the hell am I supposed to find a point? Garbage, Joyce.
I agree with Toby. I think it's a story of hope and tolerance.
Yes, it's about time that the people who get picked on get to be the heroes.
It's an entertaining flick and all, and I can see why you like it, Toby. But those people on the screen ain't even supposed to be you, man. They're college students who live with their parents in big houses in the suburbs. You know, they're going to get degrees, get good jobs, and they're going to stop being nerds, man.
I told you about loud talking. Use your inside voice, please.
Look, Toby. The guys in that movie are not 28-year-old file clerks who live with their grandmother in an ethnic ghetto.
All right, that's enough,
Harvey. They didn't get their computers the way you did by trading a bunch of box tops and $49.50 at the supermarket, man.
You're funny, Harvey.
Getting in the front.
Sure, Toby, fine. You go to the movies and daydream, but this Revenge of the Nerds ain't reality. It's Hollywood bullshit, Tobe.
Harvey, let him alone.
Terry spoke with Paul Giamatti in 2002 and asked him if there was a type of movie role he was most likely to land.
What kind of roles do you think you're thought of for? Is there like a Paul Giamatti role?
Wow. I guess I would say, I mean, I seem to play guys who are not, I never seem to play the out-and-out bad guy, and I certainly never play the good guy. I seem to play sort of the muddled, confused, vaguely pathetic guys. I mean, it seems like it. I mean, within that, I seem to play a range of guys. I mean, I can play very aggressive, pathetic guys. And, but, I mean, definitely in more so it happens to me in movies, I think, that I'm thought of for the same sorts of things. I don't know whether it's that I see people, I just tend to see the weaknesses in people and that interests me or something. I don't know.
I think the role you're probably best known for is your role in the Howard Stern movie Private Parts, in which you play the NBC programming executive who Stern nicknames Pig Vomit. And, yeah. And your most famous scene is the scene when you first meet Howard Stern, in which you're trying to explain to him that it's really important to say the call letters the right way. So yeah. Let me play that scene. This is your first meeting with Howard Stern at the NBC studios in New York.
Oh, Howard. The way we work here at NBC is a more professional manner than you're probably used to. Now, see, I don't care about what you did down in Washington, because that's chicken radio. Here at NBC, this is real radio. And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay? Now, I'm going to teach you how to say them. All right? And, you know, I hope you can get them. Because, see, you don't have a real good voice like I'm as Captain Frank and nothing. So we're going to have to practice it.
Well, you mean practicing here now?
You're not going to get bashful on me now, are you, Howard? Okay, you ready? The way it's said properly is WNBC. This is key. Come on.
WNBC.
No, you got to be more like this. Listen up. WNBC. You hear that kind of lift? The NBC.
WNBC. 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 In my mind, I'm hearing, it sounds like I'm saying exactly what you're saying.
No, actually.
WNBC.
You know what? You gotta listen to Imus. Imus does it perfectly. Tell you what, I'm gonna take you down to Imus's office right now, and you're gonna hear how he does it. Come on, boy.
Now, this is the role of somebody who thinks he's really smart, who thinks he's got a lot of power, but he's just being made fun of and made to look weak all the time by Howard Stern. So can you talk a little bit about playing that part?
That was, like you say, what was fun about that was this guy has this sense of enormous power that he's just, you know, he's going to break Howard Stern, and that was fun. I remember in playing that part, the key thing with that part I remember was I really wanted to have a big old chunky college ring on, like one of those with the big, you know, the big chunky bronze colored thing with the big blue gem in the middle. And because I thought this was the kind of guy who was, you know, he could never be on the football team, but he hung out with the jocks. And this was the kind of guy he hung out in the big jockey frat, but he was a knucklehead, and he was never, never the guy that he thought he was. You know, he always styled himself. And, you know, when he ran the college radio station, and he was very, you know, for some reason that ring was, like, really key to a guy who kind of, he imagined himself being such a kind of bigger, much more kind of macho guy than he actually was. So that ring became really essential to me, and I had to hunt one down, and that really was important for me, that ring.
Where'd you get the ring?
I don't know, some weird little costume jewelry place down the Lower East Side somewhere. You know, it was just a fake one. But, I really, that was a key thing. And also, I remember, that was interesting because it was the first time I'd done something a part that big, and it was the first time I'd done something that comical on film, and it was fun doing that with because I thought, oh, this is going to be tricky. There's no audience. I won't have a laugh coming. But what became great about that was I forgot it was supposed to be funny, and I just played it actually as straight as I could in a way. So it became fun just not having to worry about being funny and just totally investing in this guy's sense of his own self and power. It was fun.
Paul Giamatti speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with Paul Giamatti.
Let me ask you about another part. You were in Saving Private Ryan. Describe your role in that.
I played a guy. Well, that's true. I don't think I even remember the name of the guy I played. I think he had a name. I played a paratrooper sergeant. I don't know if he had a name. I think that was kind of a part where there wasn't much of a part there. I mean, I've had to do that a couple of times where, you know, I've gone in on something and they've said, well, gee, you know, you're not really right for anything, but we'd like you to be in this movie. That's what happened with that. And they were like, well, we kind of want to have this character in this scene who guides Tom Hanks around, and he's a paratrooper sergeant, and we don't really know what we want him to do. But so I play a paratrooper sergeant who takes Tom Hanks to the wrong Private Ryan. And it developed as we did it that I was a little inept. I fell over a lot, and I sort of fell through a brick wall, and I was really kind of not the most competent member of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Is that something that you put into the story or that was written in for you?
It started to develop that way is what happened. I mean, it was, I just kept falling over. I kept stumbling all the time because I was wearing all that equipment was real stuff and it was heavy. And
And I'm not a very well-coordinated guy, and I wouldn't make much of a soldier, and I was slipping and falling all over the place. And so this became, and the director thought, this is interesting, this is good. So they sort of threw in stuff where I was sort of bitching about my ankles were killing me and my back is killing me, and I just became a kind of sad sack loser soldier. So it was fun the way that developed, because there really wasn't a part there. As I remember, there really wasn't much to do.
So you were the kvetch of Saving Private Ryan.
I was the kvetch of Saving Private Ryan, exactly. Very proud moment for me. It was a fun movie to do.
Now, you were in Planet of the Apes. Which ape were you?
I was the kvetch of Planet of the Apes. I was the borscht belt orangutan. I was Limbo.
What costume did you have to wear?
I had to wear an orangutan costume.
I mean, describe it. What was it like to be in it?
I had to wear a very elaborate, full prosthetic covering my entire head, rubber, late some kind of foam, very light foam latex. And I had to wear rubber gloves and enormous rubber feet. And I had a large belly, like orangutans do. They have these kind of big pendulous bellies. And so I wore this very beautiful, elaborate rubber mask, basically.
Is it any fun to be in a costume movie like that?
Yeah. I it's the kind of thing that I've always wanted to do. I mean, it's the kind of thing when I was a kid. I mean, for me, the things that really excited me about acting when I was a kid, sort of pretending, and the things that really got me going when I was a kid were all the sort of old Universal horror movies, all the sort of Wolfman and, Frankenstein, the creature from the Black Lagoon, and all that kind of stuff. So this was my opportunity to, to do that kind of thing. And I enjoyed the heck out of it. It was really fun. And it was fun to completely disappear. It's something where you really can't see who it is really fun, too.
Where did you see those horror movies? When I was growing up, they were on TV all the time. But that was in the 50s and 60s. And you're younger than that. And I think by the time you were growing up, they weren't on TV all the time.
No, they were still on TV. In the early 70s, they were still on TV. They still had this sort of creature feature. You know, there was Creature Features and WNEW in New York. And there was Chiller. There was a thing called Chiller where they would
Chiller
show
Theater?
Those things. Yeah, Chiller Theater. And it was on Channel 11 and in New York. They definitely showed them. They showed all of those old Lon Chaney Jr. things. The Indestructible Man was a big one that made a big impression on me as a kid, where they try to electrocute. They put him in the electric chair and it only energizes him more. And he goes on a rampage. I loved those things. But they definitely showed them when I was a kid still.
So is there a kind of role or a kind of movie that you haven't done yet that you really want to do?
I'd like to play a really calm person. I'd like to play a really sort of calm person. I think that would be nice. I've been lucky in that I've gotten to play lots of different things. I mean, I don't know if there's any specific role that I can think of off the top of my head. You know, I haven't in my life gotten as much of a chance to do things like Shakespeare and stuff like that. I would like to do something like that more on stage, I guess. But I really would, actually. I mean, I'm sort of joking, but not entirely. I mean, it would be interesting. It would be challenging for me to play something more low-key. And I don't know what that is, but I mean, something that required my energy to be not so outward would be challenging for me.
You know how you were kidding before that you play the Jewish role in things, like you were the Borscht Belt guy in Planet of the Apes and the Kvetchy guy in Saving Private Ryan. I mean, you're Italian, right?
Yes, this is true. But I don't think I've ever played an Italian.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I can remember going in. I auditioned for something once, and it was an Italian. The role was of an Italian policeman, and he was very sort of, kind of smacking his kid in the back of the head, and it was very sort of, hey, shut up, hey, Joey, sit down, that kind of thing. And I was doing a lot of this stuff, and the guy kept stopping me and going, okay, that's great. Try it this way, try it this way. And then he would go, and don't forget, you're Italian.
And then he would sit, and then he would sit back, and I would do it again. And he would say, "Okay, great, do it like this, and don't forget you're Italian." And he'd sit back, and I finally said to him, "What do you mean, don't forget I'm Italian?" Basically, the idea was that I wasn't being enough, sort of like, "Hey, Joey, shut up." I wasn't doing enough of that for this guy. And I said to the guy, "I am Italian." And he went, "Well, I know, but you're not being Italian." So, I mean, it was there's a lot of that kind of thing. I've never played an Italian. And I don't look Italian. In other words, I don't have dark hair and dark complexion. So I don't fit the idea of an Italian, I guess. I have played a lot of Jews, actually. I've played lots of Jewish characters.
And why do you think?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, Paul Giamatti, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Paul Giamatti speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Giamatti got his big break the following year, playing Harvey Pekar in the movie American Splendor. One of the wonderful scenes in that movie showed how Pekar got his big break. While having lunch at a diner with his old friend, underground comic artist R. Crumb, Pekar revealed his idea for his own comic book. Giamatti plays Pekar, and James Urbaniak plays R. Crumb.
So, anyway, I tried writing some stuff about real life, you know, stuff that the everyman's got to deal with.
These are all about you?
Yeah.
You turn yourself into a comic hero.
Well, sort of, yeah, but, you know, there's no idealized shit. You know, there's no phony bullshit. This is the real thing, man. You know, ordinary life is pretty complex stuff.
These are really good.
Really, you think so?
Yeah, this is great stuff. I dig it. Can I take them home and illustrate them?
Wow, man! You'd really do that for me, man? Oh, man, that would be great, because I can't even draw a straight line, Bob.
A scene from the film American Splendor, with James Urbaniak as R. Crumb and Paul Giamatti as Harvey Pekar. American Splendor is up for an Oscar nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. Harvey Pekar lives in Cleveland, Ohio. For the past few years, he's recorded a number of commentaries, which have been broadcast on NPR member station WKSU in Kent, Ohio. Here's a piece he recorded for Valentine's Day.
Well, of course, my thoughts on Valentine's Day turn initially to my wife, Joyce, which is as it should be, but also to two important creatures who I care a great deal about, my cats, Phoebe and Phoenix. Actually, when I married my wife at age 43, I got her cat, Inky, as well. Up to that time, I'd never had a pet and didn't want one. They were just extra work, and Inky didn't appear to be my kind of an ideal cat. Joyce had rescued him from an animal shelter when he was about 6 months old, and he'd already developed some antisocial attitudes by then. He had a mean streak, like he'd come up and start licking my sweaty hand, not out of friendship, but because he liked salt. After he'd gotten his fill of salt, he'd bite me, literally bite the hand that fed him. And he liked to climb up on top of high things and then jump on me, often leaping off a bureau and landing with all 4 feet on my stomach when I was in bed. At first, I considered him a nuisance, but then I started watching him, noticing how he solved problems like opening doors and getting to food that was stashed in hard-to-get-at places. He definitely had cognitive ability. He figured out how to get around difficulties so unique that his solutions couldn't be attributed to instinct. As a result of this, I started reading books about animal cognitive powers, which are far greater than is generally recognized. I found out that human beings aren't the only animals that can reason, play, and express warmth. At that point, I started regarding Inky as more a companion than a pet. He never did get to be friendly in the cuddly sense, but we developed a sort of mutual respect. Once I remember losing my temper about something he did and tossing him off of me. He hit a wall and apparently had the wind knocked out of him or something like that. As he lay on the ground, seemingly unable to catch his breath, I ran up to him and started petting and apologized to him. After a few seconds, he gathered himself and walked, not ran, away from me, as if he had contempt for me for using my superior strength unfairly. I probably misinterpreted his action in that instance. In all likelihood, he wasn't physically able to run from me. I was able to normalize our relationship, although he avoided me for several days, expressing wariness but not fear. Inky died at a ripe old age of natural causes shortly before I was diagnosed with cancer. After months of chemo and radiation therapy, I went back to work, only to find that the steroids used in my treatment had cut off the flow of blood to my right femur, and it was disintegrating, causing me to limp and be in a lot of pain. The doctor wanted me to postpone getting a hip replacement for years because it would eventually wear out. Having just gone through the cancer treatment and finding out that I'd be having hip pain for some time to come was very depressing. Partly to cheer me up, Joyce got us two kittens, and it really helped. I got involved and interested in them, and they really helped brighten my mood. They didn't care how lousy I was feeling. They still played and expressed warmth. There have been times in my life when I've had to live alone for years at a time and been very lonely. Having cats probably would have made a difference. Everyone needs unconditional love, and on Valentine's Day, I appreciate the affection of my cats.
Harvey Pekar lives in Cleveland, Ohio. Coming up, 51st Dates, a review of the new film starring Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. This is Fresh Air. Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore first teamed up in 1998 for the romantic comedy The Wedding Singer. At the time, it was a change of pace for the Saturday Night Live comic, best known for his broad slapstick farces. 6 years later, Sandler and Barrymore have reunited for 51st Dates, the story of a love-em-and-leave-em womanizer who commits to a woman who can't remember him the next morning. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
A big walrus throws up in the first 5 minutes of 51st Dates. It's a geyser of chunky stuff, spewed right into the face of an aquarium worker of comically indeterminate gender. Now, I like bad taste humor more than most people, but 15 minutes of gags like that, and I was out of there. No more jokes with penguins making rude gestures. No more Rob Schneider as a half-naked Hawaiian guy with a dead eye. And no more Adam Sandler just walking through it to collect his 20-plus million. I knew the premise. Sandler falls in love with a woman with no short-term memory, and it all seems so horribly exploitive suddenly. I close my notebook, I put on my coat, and then something weird happened. The movie got really good. The tide turned with the arrival of Drew Barrymore, who plays Lucy Whitmore, a funny and level-headed art teacher who Sandler spies in a cafe, making a castle out of her waffles. He plays someone named Henry Roth, not the legendary writer, but an Arctic Marine veterinarian marking time in Hawaii, where he makes it with single women tourists. Henry likes to leave his lovers with fantastic excuses but golden memories, and the fact that Lucy is a local makes him edgy. But he is plainly smitten, and so we can see is she.
Would you like to have breakfast again tomorrow morning, same time? Because I teach an art class at 10.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I wish I could make it, but yes, I will be there. Take care.
Okay.
Ooh.
One for the road. Ooh, it's fishy.
Got you good, eh? Aloha.
Aloha.
See you tomorrow.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
You know from the premise that when Henry shows up the next day for their date, she'll have no idea who he is. That's when he learns that she had a car accident that injured the part of the brain that holds new memories. She's fine with everything up to the accident on her dad's birthday, but each morning she wakes up and the previous day's slate has been wiped clean. This is all rather sad and creepy for a gross-out comedy, but the script by George Wing quickly changes gears. We meet Lucy's dad, played by Blake Clark, and her brother, played by Sean Astin. They not only protect her from operators like Henry, but from knowledge of her own condition. They relive her dad's birthday over and over. They have cake. They let Lucy paint wondrous designs on the wall of her dad's workshop. Then they say goodnight and take white paint and cover over everything she did. My guess is that Wing's original script didn't have a lot of walrus barf jokes, but Sandler knows his base. The fans who turned out for Mr. Deeds were outraged over that lyrical absurdist romance, punch-drunk love. So there's lots of slapstick in the margins. But the movie stays bravely true to its premise. Sandler's Henry keeps coming back, trying to win Lucy over and over. When she learns of her condition, she becomes a collaborator. She even gives him advice on how to approach her. She says she can't believe she falls for his egg-shaped head every day. Sandler is on the verge of seeming too comfortable with himself, but the warmth of his lazy delivery sneaks up on you, and he surrounds himself with actors he plainly likes. As Lucy's dad, Clark gives a beautifully croaky performance. Sean Astin is fuddled and funny, and Dan Aykroyd has a touching scene as a brain surgeon who reminds Lucy that her important sense of humor region is unimpaired. Even Rob Schneider is... No, maybe not. Never mind. Barrymore brings out something tender in Sandler, and in the audience, too. It's strange to think of her as coming from a royal theatrical family. Part of her charm is a kind of inspired amateurishness. Her melting sweetness does indeed make every first date seem believably new. There's a larger issue buried here, a good one to think about on Valentine's Day. Again and again, Lucy is wooed and won, and says, "There's nothing like a first kiss." Wing and director Peter Siegel have built a comedy around the thrill of first attraction, the sadness that it can't last, and the challenge of finding something in the heart to hang on to.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate.
My name is Cupid Valentino, the modern day Cupid, and I just want to say one thing. Happy Valentine's Day.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Ian Chillog directed the show. Our Harvey Pekar commentary was produced by Eric Newsom at NPR member station WKSU. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Yeah, now look at here, he straight for your heart. Now, and he won't miss you. But that's all right. Y'all won't believe in me anyway, but...
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Nonesuch Records, featuring mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson's recording of Bach cantatas numbers 82 and 199. More information available at nonesuch.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm just a poor... wayfaring stranger.
On the next Fresh Air, producer Rick Rubin. Once known for his hip-hop and heavy metal work, he was Johnny Cash's record producer in the last years of Cash's life. A new box set of their work together is out now. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
No toil nor danger in that bright land.